tune, allowing us then to be so much closer to David, the other psalm writers, to experience precisely what they were doing. Now, each of these psalms were originally songs. They were sung publicly. They were sung, with every sort of emotion that we can imagine, as there's a psalm for everything that you can experience in this life, I suppose. So I want to thank Ted for that. And as a matter of fact, at the conclusion of this sermon, we'll be singing another song that has been derived directly from one of those psalms. I wanted to start this evening, though, with a kind of a grim chart that will set the stage for a temptation that Joseph had faced. And this will be our sixth lesson with regard to the life of Joseph, derived from thoughts that were written by Don Bassett into his book that he called the Joseph Code. And so when I was asked to present this material and using that as a sort of a basis for these evening sermons, as you look through the book, you'll find, of course, that in the earlier lessons, they're very directly related to information that we can see printed in the book of Genesis about the life of this man, Joseph. In these last lessons or two, and in the latter part of the book there, we will be looking at material that is outside of the book of Genesis. We're familiar with the life of Joseph now, but seeing experiences that he had, knowing that he handled them well, we'll be looking at a variety of scriptures here this evening that show how to combat various problems that can assail us as Christians, as they did for Joseph so long ago. And in this grim chart that are afflicting people of every walk of life, and I suppose always have. And you won't be able to read this, the small part here. I'll be highlighting just various parts as I, reveal each line here. But what this is the leading causes of death in the United States, a chart that comes from 2016. So while at first blush it may not sound that recent, typically with these kind of statistics, you can't get, closer than two or three years behind as they collect all this data and eventually get it, into such charts. But what this is the rank 1 through 10, and then breaking out these causes of death from ages 10 through 14, 15 to 24, 25 to 34, 35 to 44, 45 to 54, 55 to 64, 65 plus, and then an average, for just all ages. You'll see in a moment that as I was hunting for such statistics, one category that causes people to die is going to be highlighted in blue on this chart. And we'll have our tie-in, of course, then to Joseph as well. At first, though, for each of these age groups, the number one thing that kills people in those age groups is unintentional injury, unintentional injury, unintentional injury, unintentional injury, up to age 45. And then, of course, malignant neoplasms takes the next two decades, heart disease for 65 plus. And so if you average all of this out, take all of those, the thing that's killing, number one, more people in America each year is going to prove to be heart disease. There's an awful lot of unintentional injury, but so many people are dying from heart disease, that's the number one killer. Well, that's not something we're going to be studying in our Bibles. But as we then reveal the second cause of death, it is stunning to me, and it has been for many years. It's certainly a major concern, should be for all of us, that in the years, the ages of 10 to 14, the number two killer in that age group is suicide. In the second decade of 15 to 24, the number two killer in that age group is suicide. In the third decade, 25 to 34, the number two killer, highlighted in blue, is suicide. Well, then we go down, as you age, malignant neoplasms, heart disease again, and now it's malignancies that are killing more people in all age groups as the number two killer right there. But here we've got from 10 to 34, what is the number two reason why people in those 30 years die?
It's because of suicide. And it's just, you know, at first, so shocking, so seemingly unthinkable. Do you know, less than 7 days ago, I talked to a lifelong friend of mine, and she told me about an 11-year-old boy who was taken out of the school and is now getting counseling because of a suicide attempt on the school grounds. That's just, you know, you'd think it's just unbelievably impossible. How can that be? It is a thing that we need at least to be conscious of and to recognize that in our minds when we think, well, what's the biggest problem that, you know, a kid up to age 14 has, or maybe up to 24, or maybe up to 34, you know, we are sorely tempted to think that the emotional trials and travails in those age groups ought not to be such a big deal, because after all, in the first part, they're living at home anyway, and they don't have to pay bills, they don't have to go to work and all that. All they got to do is go to school, you know, and so it just doesn't cross our minds. You've got to be alert to this. Those are staggering statistics. Then, number three, and again, we're not interested. You can tell it's the suicide one that I was actually hunting for. Got malignancies again. Homicide enters the list now in ages 15 to 24. We still got heart disease, unintentional injury, but you know, there's a wide variety of different things there. But look what happens as the number four killer by age groups. The number four killer for age groups 35 to 44 and 45 to 54 is, guess what? Suicide. The number two and the number four thing that is killing people is that they're taking their own lives here in America. It's recently, you know, these studies is 2016. So I'm not concerned about each and every one of these. The next one comes up as the number eight. And finally, and you're seeing a pattern develop now. So number two for the younger ages. Then a fourth killer is ages 35 to 54. We've got to go down several lines to see suicide show up as number eight for ages 55 to 64. And then you got to go another line down here as the number 10 killer is suicide for all ages. It is suicide when you average all the way across. It's number 10. So, brethren, I can appreciate heart disease. I can appreciate unintentional injury. I can appreciate, you know, malignant neoplasms, whatever they may be. But to see suicide come up as the number two, the number four, the number eight, and then the tenth killer covering every single age group at some point except 65 plus. Today's my 67th birthday. I'm home free. Well, we laugh. You know, I can appreciate by that age, if life has not ground you to such a pulp that you've actually attempted suicide and succeeded in this chart, you know, so very often, by that stage in your life, you really are wanting to live longer. You're thinking about seeing grandkids get off, you know, and start getting married. You're thinking about great-grandkids. You've developed now, having successfully passed these other age groups, you know, perhaps a stronger desire to be living. But that, to me, is a stunning chart. How's it got anything to do with Joseph? Joseph's early life was really tough. And when suicide was the number two killer in those early years, as Joseph was passing through those early years, he was 17 when he was sold into slavery by his brothers. He was 30 when he got freed from the prison after the mistreatment of the master's wife. So he spent a total of 13 years either as a slave or as a prisoner, having been falsely accused. He spent at least, we are told, 2 years in prison, but it may have been significantly more. There's just no way to tell. You know, he wound up in prison. We know that he was forgotten by one of the men whose dream he had accurately interpreted for another 2 years. So we get that two-year figure, but it doesn't tell us when he went in, only that it was 2 years after the dreams that he finally got out. So one just has to wonder, is that chart so rare and new and different and unique to America? I doubt it. I suppose that had we any such kinds of statistics, we'd probably find it generally wherever you live. These kinds of emotional attacks upon us, years of fearfulness, confusion, lacking confidence, not sure about our futures, the younger you are, the more likely you are to be contemplating or even succeeding at suicide. And throughout these years, 17 to 30, what was Joseph doing? Well, anything but suicide. He's being mistreated as badly as anybody's ever been. We learned from one of the Psalms a few weeks back that he was in chains for much of this time. And so he's been suffering terribly. But we have also seen him do what? When he became a slave, he immediately rose to what position in his master's home and affairs? Most trusted employee that he had. Okay? Then when he got thrown in jail, he was there at least 2 years. But at the end of these years, what do we find that Joseph is in the jail? Number two in command there, the most trusted man that even a jailer can use to keep his population, you know, at peace and in properly functioning. So along these lines, we've already come to appreciate that where others, according to that previous chart, throughout the ages, I suppose, might have just said, I can't handle it, I can't take it, I give up, I am done with this. That was not Joseph's attitude, though he was facing the worst of life's problems. Now, I haven't used this verse previously, but wanted to throw it into the mix here because it is a kind of a nice, I think, a capper or overall description of Joseph's attitude, both as a slave and as a prisoner. In Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verses 10 and 11, it says, "Whatever your hand finds to do." That's a pretty broad statement. What he found to do was to be a slave and then to be a prisoner. But whatever your hand finds to do, do it with what? With all your might, the wisest man who ever lived says we should do. For there is no activity or planning or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol where you're going. You're going to die eventually anyway. Why hasten the process? And in the meantime, no matter what you're suffering, Joseph stands as that perfect example. You just put your hand to the work that comes to hand as vigorously as you can, and you'll rise through the ranks. You reap what you sow. So we've been studying now twice in the course of the last several weeks. Verse 11 says, "I again saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, the battle is not to the warriors. Neither is bread to the wise, nor wealth to the discerning, nor favor to men of ability." Now, why did he say those words, and what idea is he trying to get across? Is it guaranteed that if you're the fastest guy around, you're going to always win the race? No. Things happen. Is it always true that the warriors win? No, they're fighting against somebody else who are also warriors, and you're going to lose. Bread to the wise. Some of the smartest people you've ever found don't have $2 to rub together. They may have the IQ, but don't know how to apply it. Neither is wealth to the discerning. Likewise, you have a tremendous amount of, you know, understanding. And if you pay any attention to politics, you know, you've all felt that way, haven't you? The people that are budgeting all the tax money that we send to them, how smart do you think they are? Well, their IQ is probably 50 points higher than ours. Does that mean that they know how to handle the American budget? You don't think so, do you? I don't. And they prove it, you know, time and time again. They don't spend it well. Nor favored men of ability. People who deserve honor and respect above everybody else in the world are called Christians. They're doing their level best to be the living image of the Son of God who never sinned, who is the wisest man who ever lived, who is the kindest, most compassionate, and patient man who ever lived, who is the most highly developed, perfect human being the world has ever seen. And what are we trying to be? Just like Him.
And that's why they're always throwing parades for Christians, right?
Well, maybe not. Okay? The people then that should receive the favor and glory from men, you know, often don't have the ability, get no recognition whatsoever. But it's that last line, time and chance overtake them all. Are you in control of your life circumstances? Not really. Sure, we have responsibility, do the best we can. We're going to try to make every right decision we know how. But even if you're the fastest and you're the strongest and you're the wisest and you're the most discerning and you have all the ability that there is, can time and chance just wreck your house of cards? Sure it can. And what was Joseph? Handpicked by the Lord of glory to be a prophet who was able to interpret dreams, and his own dreams, for that reason, was sold by his brothers into slavery and eventually wound up in prison for having done not one thing wrong. So, brother, we know this about Joseph. We understand this about Joseph. Tonight, we're going to take a look at some related passages that have to do with your attitude in times of stress and duress, when you recognize that you're just a feather in, you know, a hurricane, you haven't got control of it, and Satan is whispering in your ear, just give up. Just give up. Become a good worrier. Never mind that in the Philippian letter we are forbidden to do such. Be anxious for nothing, we're told in that fourth chapter. No, Satan always whispering. What you need is to feel sorrow. What you need is to feel angst. You need to wallow in all your emotions. You need to explore them, you know, with the psychologist and try to dredge up every one that you've long since forgotten, which is where it should be anyway. You know, and so we're constantly being barraged with this temptation to place too much emphasis, care, and concern upon what? The things of this life rather than the things of the Spirit. Well, Joseph didn't fall prey to any of that. And I'd suggest that it's likely because, while we won't read this verse until 1 Thessalonians, 52 years, you know, A.D., so nearly 1,800 years after Joseph was living, but still in 1 Thessalonians 4:13, we are told, we do not what? Grieve as those who what? Have no hope. Now, in the context there, we're talking about saints that have died and gone on, you know, before the Lord returns. We understand the context. The principle will be true on every page of your Bible. When you're scared, when you're confused, when you have serious issues going on, whatever age group you're in, from young children of 10 on up to whatever you happen to be today, you will have grievous experiences. And sure enough, you could just go home and lament, oh, woe is me. But the Christian, in no circumstance, up to and including confronting death itself in your own family, the people you love the most, we do not react to these awful circumstances like the people who have no hope. The Christian hope changes everything. The Christian's knowledge and viewpoint changes everything. The Christian, like Joseph of so long ago, can face the worst kinds of injustices that have ever been suffered and still put their hand to the plow and never look back. They can still, whatever their hand finds to do, do it with all their might. They can still be free from anxiety. They can still march on and do the best they can with the circumstances that they have. So this is kind of an overarching principle. We don't grieve as those who have no hope. I'd just like to look at a couple of passages here this evening, starting with Psalm 27. Now, these I won't be putting up on the screen. You'll have to turn to look at them. We'll be in Psalm 27 in this case, and looking at verses 7 through 14. Hear, O Lord, when I cry with my voice. Be gracious to me and answer me. When you said, seek my face, my heart said to you, your face, O Lord, I will seek. You told me to do it, I'm going to do it.
Now, obviously, from "Hear, O Lord, when I cry with my voice," we've got an individual who's suffering. We've got an individual facing grievous problems in his life. It is a Psalm of David, but he's firmly got his feet planted. I won't grieve. I won't despair. I won't give up. So when God says, just seek God's face in your troubles, David's heart responds, indeed, that's exactly what I'm going to do. Verse 9, he prays, do not hide your face from me. Do not turn your servant away in anger. You've been my help. Do not abandon me, nor forsake me, O God of my salvation. For my father and my mother have forsaken me, but the Lord will take me up. I can depend upon you, Lord God, more than my parents. You will not forsake me, even if my parents forsook me. Verse 11, teach me your way, O Lord. Lead me in a level path because of my foes. Do not, do not deliver me over to the desire of my adversaries. For false witnesses have risen against me, think of Joseph, and such as breathe out violence, think of his brothers. I would have despaired unless I had believed that I would see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Wait for the Lord, David says. Be strong, David says. Let your heart take courage, David says. Yes, wait for the Lord. David ends his psalm. Now, if you know anything about the life of David, you know there have been, you know, few sufferers like him. Job might be able to argue for the title, but David had come in a close second, if not first, for having suffered problems in the course of his life. But what does Psalm 27 say? David, who knew the worst of the worst, David, his own firstborn son, betrayed him and drove him off the throne and out into the wilderness. David, who had a king chase him for years and make 11 attempts on his life. David teaches us that faith will sustain you. You do not grieve or suffer like those who have no hope. And his hope was not limited, we'll say, to the knowledge that even if I die, I get to go to heaven. That's true. But he said, I would despair if I'd not thought in terms of seeing God save me in the land of the living. He never gave up that hope, no matter what he was going through. God will rescue me in his own good time. God will rescue me because he has promised so to do. I'll wait as long as I have to, as bad as it is. This apparently was Joseph's attitude as well. Never abandoned his God in the midst of his trials, nor should we. Now, Hebrews chapter 12, we'll be coming back to Psalms in a minute if you want to put a hand in there, but I want to skip over to Hebrews now. Here's this, immensely famous 12th chapter. Now, we've been thinking as you are passing through the 11th chapter of all the examples of the faithful that have gone before, the great cloud of witnesses that's mentioned then, the successful ones in the early part of chapter 12. But we're going to pick up now at verse 11 in that 12th chapter. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful. That's what it seems it is. Yet to those who have been trained by it, afterwards, it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. Now, brother, for just one second, ask yourself, what is righteousness worth to you? What would you suffer or pay to own the peaceful fruit of righteousness? And aren't we being told already in this 11th verse to have that peaceful fruit of righteousness? One must pay for it, pass through these fires of suffering, successfully so. Afterwards, it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. Therefore, here comes our conclusion in verse 12, strengthen the hands that are weak. That's your job. and the knees that are feeble. That's your job. Nobody else is going to do it for you. Make straight paths for your feet. That's your job. That the limb which is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed, is up to you. Pursue peace with all men and the sanctification without which no one will see the Lord. See to it that no one comes short of the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springing up causes trouble, and by it many be defiled. Well, brethren, I'm just going to, you know, reference this in passing. We've got several other verses to be looking at, but there's sure enough a whole sermon in there, isn't there? Our knowledge of all the past faithful saints, our knowledge of the certain and inevitable future of heaven itself, our confidence, like David's, that God is always watching and always cares, and our understanding that even in suffering, God is training me, God is perfecting me. James says the same things. You know, it's everywhere. God is working with me. I will not despair. I will learn. I will grow. I will triumph. I will be so much more than I would have been. I will reach out and pluck from that tree the peaceful fruit of righteousness, because it is more valuable than anything. That's what I'll do. I will not succumb to confusion, to despair. Far be it from me, I think in terms of ending my life when times are hard. Now we come to 2 Corinthians chapter 1. In 2 Corinthians chapter 1, of course, here verses 3 through 11 then, this is how the very book begins. It's the first thing that the Spirit fills Paul's mind with as he writes this, what we know as the second letter, second recorded letter at least, which in 2 Corinthians 1, verses 3 through 11, Paul begins in this manner. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies, the God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our afflictions. He does not promise to remove all or even any of your afflictions. He promises a way of escape, a way of learning through the faith that sustains us, we've already put here. But in 2 Corinthians now, he should be blessed. He's the Father of mercies. He's the God of comfort in all our afflictions. He'll be there to comfort us so that we may be able to comfort those who are in any affliction with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. Now, brethren, there is a high standard, and you're all being called to it if you're a reader of your New Testament and a respecter of the wisdom that's found there. We are the comforters. We are the people that are supposed to be there for all of those who can't be with us, who, because of age, because of disease, because of mental infirmity or whatever it is, those who have proven themselves for so many long years, you know, can no longer be with us. Are we to forsake them or to comfort them? Comfort them the way God comforts us is what these verses say. Verse 5, for just as the sufferings of Christ are ours in abundance, yes, they are. Paul was certainly going through his. So also our comfort is abundant through Christ. But if we are afflicted, Paul says personally now, it's for your comfort and salvation. Or if we are comforted, it's for your comfort, which is effective in the patient enduring the same sufferings, which we also suffer. And our hope for you is firmly grounded, knowing that as you are sharers of our sufferings, so also you are sharers of our comforts. For we do not want you to be unaware, brethren, of our affliction which came to us in Asia. We were burdened excessively beyond our strength. And here's the key phrase for this passage. We do not want you to be unaware, brethren, of our afflictions, that we were burdened excessively beyond our strength, so that we despaired even of life. Now, I've been teaching you're not supposed to despair. You're supposed to accept God's comfort, learn through God's sufferings, triumph over these things by way of your hope and your faith. When he says, I despaired of life, he's not saying that he became morose, you know, and just pulled the covers over his head and quit trying. He's saying, I could see no way out. I was sure I was going to die. I couldn't see any way out of it. So I despaired of life in the sense that I couldn't imagine any way but death that lay at my doorstep. Now he says, though, in verse 9, indeed, we had the sentence of death within ourselves. In order, he came to that impasse, in order that we should not trust in ourselves, but in God who raises the dead, who delivered us from so great a peril of death. He couldn't see the way out, but God provided one. Will deliver us. He on whom we've set our hope, he will yet deliver us. You also joining and helping us through your prayers, that thanks may be given by many persons on behalf of the favor bestowed upon us through the prayers of many. All Paul is opening up this second letter saying is, everything I've ever experienced, I did it for you, Corinthians. And it's all good. Whatever I've suffered, it's all fine. I'm doing it for you. Even when I thought I was going to die, and I was forced to depend upon my God utterly because I was without any idea, then that confidence met its reward. Surprised as I was that I got out of there alive. 2 Corinthians chapter 4 adds a little bit to this, just a few chapters later, in verses 6 through 11. God, who said, light shall shine out of darkness, is the one who has shown in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. But we have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the surpassing greatness of the power, we saw this in 1 Corinthians chapter 2 this morning, may be of God and not from ourselves. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not despairing. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. Always carrying about in the body the dying of Jesus, that the life of Jesus also may be manifest in our body. For we who live are constantly being delivered over to death for Jesus' sake, that the life of Jesus also may be manifested in our mortal flesh. How precious is the fruit of righteousness, the peaceful fruit of righteousness to you. Is it worth going through the things that Paul did, coming to an absolute certainty that I'm going to die, so that you could learn that service, even if it kills me, is worth it? It's okay. It's what God has called us to. I will serve my God. I will grow in the knowledge of my God. I will get stronger in my faith by means of these things that I think are going to kill me. That's what Joseph did. It's what Paul did. It's what hosts have done in Hebrews chapter 11. And brethren, it's what we're called to do as well. So we're going to close this evening with Psalm now 42. Psalm 42. This 42nd Psalm, I suspect, you're going to instantly recognize. This 42nd Psalm is the Psalm from which the next song that we'll be singing is derived. Psalm 42 and verse 1 says, as the deer pants for the water brooks, so my soul pants for you, O God. My soul thirsts for God. Now might I just parenthetically say, even if I think it's going to kill me, I'll still seek my God. That's what we learned in the preceding verses. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. When shall I come and appear before God? My tears have been my food day and night, while they say to me all day long, where's your God? See how he's mocked. These things I remember. I pour out my soul within me, for I used to go along with the throng and lead them in procession to the house of God with a voice of joy and thanksgiving, a multitude keeping festival. Yeah, I remember the good old days. But now in 5, why are you in despair, O my soul? Now, as you look at that 5th verse, be careful. Why are you in despair, O my soul? It's not him criticizing God. It's not him doubting God. It's not him saying, this isn't fair. I shouldn't be suffering like this. Why should I be in despair? It's not that at all. He's saying, it's just so wrong to be in despair. It's just so ridiculous to be in despair. It doesn't matter what's happening in my life. It's just unthinkable that I would descend into that. So he says, why are you in despair, O my soul? Why have you become disturbed within me? Hope in God. So when he tastes that despair, the psalmist, one of the sons of Korah apparently, when he feels those terrible times, how does he respond? He says, well, hope in God. For I shall again praise him. David said the same thing. The help of his presence. Oh my God, my soul is in despair within me. Therefore, I remember you from the land of the Jordan and the peaks of Hermon, from Mount Mizar. Deep calls to deep at the sound of your waterfalls. All your breakers and waves have rolled over me. The Lord will command his loving kindness in the daytime. His song will be with me in the night. A prayer to the God of my life. I will say to God, my rock, why have you forgotten me? Sounds desperate, doesn't he? But read on. See the point he's trying to make. Why do I go mourning because of the oppression of the enemy? He's feeling it. He's tempted. But he's combating it. No, I wouldn't do that. Why would I do that? Verse 10. As a shattering of my bones, my adversaries revile me while they say to me all day long, where's your God? Why are you in despair, O my soul? Why have you become disturbed within me? Hope in God, for I shall yet praise him, the help of my countenance and my God. He is tempted to this. And he is denying this. It's bad, bad. So what? I will be faithful to my God. I will hope in my God. I will triumph over these circumstances. I will not despair. It's foolish. It's silly to despair. Not me, the psalmist says. And not Joseph, so long ago, till he found himself second in command of a land that 3,700 years ago had 800-year-old pyramids already. The Sphinx was about 800 years old when Joseph was there. I will not despair. So you'll never find me, the psalmist says, the writer of Hebrews says, David says, in the list of the suicides. I don't care if it's the number 2 cause of death for 30-year span. I don't care if it's number 4. I don't care if it's number 8. I don't care if it's number 10 for everybody. Not me. Because I am what? I am a child of God. Despair will be unknown in my heart. Just like it was utterly absent in the life of young Joseph. So, my hope, of course, is that you can just thrill to these passages and say, you know, I can do this. God has promised. Some of you are suffering. And public service announcement, if in fact you've ever thought about suicide, call me up. Talk to one of the elders. We will guide you through scriptures and help comfort you, as we read earlier, for that's our job. Turn to your faithful brethren. They'll show you an ultimate reason to live on, to prosper from these experiences, and to triumph over them. So, if we can help in any way, whatever circumstances you're facing, prayer and Bible study, certainly if you're ready to become a Christian tonight, then let it be known as we sing this final song now.